Guys, we'll make a start there. Welcome, everybody. Great to see you. Especially welcome if this is your first ever night at midweek. We're so glad that you're here. And welcome to 1 Samuel. Hopefully you've got a handout in front of you. You might have a prep booklet. Hopefully you've also got a Bible somewhere near you as well. You'll need all of those things. And if you've joined over summer or, you know, maybe tonight, this is not normally how we do our small group Bible studies. So normally, you would come and sit round tables elsewhere in the church, but we're doing a kind of mix and match thing tonight. Normally, I won't say things at your midweek Bible studies, but tonight I'll talk for a bit, and then there'll be some time to chat in our groups through some questions. And for 1 week only, we are going to read the passage in the study. So that's exciting. This year, some of the passages are pretty long, and there just won't be time to read them during your Bible study. It will take the whole study just to read the passage. So please, please, please serve your small group by reading the passage in advance before you come. And that will help you to start thinking about it ahead of time, and it will help your group because it means you'll come with good things to share already that you've seen from God's words. Very hard to talk about a bit of the Bible that you haven't read. Okay, so that's just a plea. But tonight, don't worry if you've not read it. You may not have even known we were doing 1 Samuel when you turned up tonight. So, you know, tonight, here's a freebie. And I've got two volunteers who are, I say volunteers, I slightly made them do it. And I'm not sure either of them were that willing. but they have agreed. So if you guys could come up. And we're going to read the passage. So flick open 1 Samuel.
There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim, of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, son of Elu, son of Tohu, son of Zuth, an Epaphrite. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship, and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Silo, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons?" After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said,
"O Lord of hosts, if you indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head."
As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart. Only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, "How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you." But Hannah answered,
"No, my Lord, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation."
Then Eli answered, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him." And she said,
"Let your servant find favor in your eyes."
Then the woman went on her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. They rose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah, and Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said,
"I have asked for him from the Lord."
The man, Elkanah, and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband,
"As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever."
Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh, and the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said,
"Oh, my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord."
And he worshipped the Lord there. And Hannah prayed and said,
"My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed."
Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest.
Thank you very much, guys. Let's give them a round of applause. There you go. Lovely. I'd like to start with some audience participation. Don't worry, it's not embarrassing or anything. It's a very simple game. I'm not sure we can even call it a game. Anyway, I'm going to say a word, and you have to decide whether you think instinctively it's good or bad. If you think it's good, just stick your hand up, and if you think it's bad, you keep your hand down. Okay? And so instinctive response, don't think about it too much. Good hand up, bad hand down. So we're going to try a few. We'll start easy. Faithfulness. Hey. Oh, Chef. That one was good, Chef. Okay. Wickedness. Very good. Having food to eat. Being hungry. Arrogance. Bringing things to life. Killing things. Being needy. Justice. Revenge. Salvation. Judgment. Deriding your enemies. Oh, it's interesting. It's got harder, hasn't it? Right, good. There's probably a few of those that you thought, I think I want a bit more detail before I decide whether that's good or bad. But they're all in Hannah's prayer. And hopefully, you know, keep that in front of you. That will help. Some of them, I think, are unambiguously bad. Chef. So faithfulness, I think, is always good. Pride and arrogance. They're clearly rebuked in verse 3, for example. Those seem to be bad. There's not very much wiggle room for wickedness, I don't think, either. You know, just by definition, I think that one has to be bad. But some of them are less clear. We wouldn't choose to be needy, but they are clearly the category of person that gets lifted up in verse 8. Or hungry, verse 5. We wouldn't choose to be hungry, I think. But the hungry person in this prayer, they cease to hunger in that verse. Whereas the full person, well, they end up having to hire themselves out for bread. So not quite as simple as we might have hoped. And then I think the hardest ones were towards the end of the list. You were clearly not sure what to do in that situation. Some people were just kind of doing this. Judgment, I think we probably know that that is supposed to happen. But we might still need persuading that that's a good thing. Deriding your enemies, most people didn't go for that as a good thing. And it kind of sounds a bit like arrogance again, doesn't it? Maybe. Revenge. Very few people put their hands up for revenge. But all of those, I think, seem to be celebrated here. Hannah is rejoicing in them. Is that okay? Are we allowed to say things like verse 1 of her prayer? My mouth derides my enemies. I heard a talk on this passage earlier this year, which was very convenient because I could just copy the good things. And the speaker began by saying, revenge is a wonderful thing. Revenge is a wonderful thing. Do you agree? Maybe you agree sort of secretly inside, but you're not sure that's really okay, so we're not going to say that out loud. Revenge is a wonderful thing. Is it? I think most of us love a story where the plot is revenge. So I thought of a few examples. So Gladiator, that's really a story all about revenge. The man is wronged, his family is murdered, but by the end of the film, he has his revenge. Taken, I will find you and I will kill you. You know, that's the good guy. We're all rooting for Liam Neeson in that film, but it's a bit weird. It's a story about revenge. The Shawshank Redemption, another favorite revenge film, I think. We love to get our own back. Before this, all the leaders got together and we had a chat about 1 Samuel and the year to come. And in front of everybody, I mildly teased one of the leaders. But he has already reminded me that he owes me one for that. And so he's storing that up for the ideal revenge moment that's hanging over me. We love a bit of revenge. But is it Christian? Christianity is about grace and forgiveness. Revenge doesn't quite feel like that fits the picture, does it? Well, I think it's possible that we might just slightly misunderstand all these words. Look back at me. Look back with me at Hannah's prayer. And just the first couple of lines again. My heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. Deriding enemies, having revenge on them. Well, really, we're talking about justice, which I think we all instinctively knew was a good thing. The salvation that Hannah rejoices in is inseparable from the judgment, from justice, from revenge. So we're going to look back at Hannah's own story. Her prayer is very helpful in the book of 1 Samuel. It would be worth reading again and again over the next couple of months because it does set up the book. But first, it's driven by Hannah's own experience of being saved by God. So in your groups, there's 2 questions to start with. Look back over chapter 1. How has Hannah been saved? And then the second question to go with that, which lines from Hannah's prayer maybe start to make particular sense in light of her individual story? So chat about that. You've got about 10 minutes. Well, if I can break into your conversations there. Hannah is somebody who knows what it is like to be mistreated, to experience the ongoing provocations of Peninnah, to live life in such obvious parallel to somebody, but with the constant reminder that she has no children. It's possible that she's named first because she was Elkanah's first wife, And some people think then the implication is that Elkanah married a second wife because Hannah couldn't give him any children. She lives her life in that very harsh contrast. And she seems to be a faithful believer. She comes with Elkanah to worship and sacrifice, and she prays. But it just added to her agony year by year. As the portions, it says, are given out to each of Peninnah's ever-increasing brood of children, to all her sons and daughters, and Hannah still has none. And it's a painful thing to want children, but to not be able to have children. There have been and will be lots of people in our own church family who can connect with that very personally. And I guess it's worst when the contrast is clearest. Say, for example, two couples married for the same length of time. One couple don't seem to be able to get pregnant. And the other couple are on their third child. They're pregnant again. And so that moment of joy in one family, that they're keen to share and to celebrate, simultaneously is a moment of heartache in another family. But it's not just that Peninnah has been a bit thoughtless, or that Hannah was, you know, caught off guard and has got a bit emotional. Verse 6 calls her rival. Her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And I wonder if you can, you know, imagine it. Just hold the baby for me, Hannah. You're not busy, are you? It's not like you've got anything to do. Could you just watch the twins for me as well? I don't know how I do it every day. Run off my feet. Still, it's all worth it to see the happy look on Elkanah's face. He always said he wanted lots of children. At least I'm doing my bit. It could be, you know, quite vicious, probably. Maybe we can see why Hannah would regard her as an enemy. And the birth of Samuel is really important for this next phase of Bible history, the story that's about to unfold. But first, he is God's salvation to Hannah. Just the hope of a prayer heard and answered means that she eats and she's no longer sad. And so I think it's quite amazing then that she, you know, she does what she promised. She gives Samuel to the Lord. People say he might well have been about 3 years old by the time he was fully weaned. And that's Florence's age. So that's like me and Fran just giving Florence to God and, you know, maybe seeing her once a year. It's quite an amazing thing. And yet seemingly, without any indecision, Hannah gives Samuel to God all the days of his life. She knows the Lord has saved her. And so she prays. My heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. And I have to assume verse 3 is directed at Peninnah. In the first instance, talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. Hannah gets her revenge. But it is an important distinction to see who does the avenging here. Her heart exults in the Lord. She rejoices in his salvation. Revenge is a wonderful thing, but it is the Lord who avenges, not us. And it is exactly because of who he is, I take it, that vengeance in his hands is a good thing, in a way that vengeance in our hands almost certainly would not be. And Hannah describes him in verse 2, there is none holy like the Lord. There is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The holy God can avenge and bring justice because he knows everything. He can weigh actions fairly, accurately, proportionately, without succumbing to impulse. There is none besides him, no one like him in that regard, no rock like our God, unchanging and immovable and sure. And so interestingly, I think as you then read through the rest of the prayer, some of the other things on the list maybe become good if God is the one doing them in his holiness. So verse 6, the Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. All of verses 4 to 10 demonstrate the Lord's salvation. And salvation has two parts to it, inseparable parts. Something is brought down and something is lifted up. Our God saves through great reversals. And almost every verse has one. Some verses have more than one. The bows of the mighty are broken. Something comes down. But the feeble bind on strength. Something is lifted up. Salvation by reversal. Or end of verse 5, that sounds a lot like Hannah's reversal, doesn't it? The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. That sounds like Hannah and Peninnah. But there are also themes here that run the whole length of the book. It's not hard to see Hannah's prayer goes way beyond her own individual story. She's talking about archers whose bows break and about princes and thrones, and she's talking about the adversaries of the Lord and judging the ends of the earth. Even, you know, technically, this barren woman who bears 7 children, Hannah actually only ever has 6 children. But she knows she is part of a bigger story. Her experience of God is typical of the way that God works. Her salvation is a microcosm of his ultimate salvation plan. And so as we read through 1 Samuel this year, expect to see many more great reversals. Expect to see proud people humbled and humble people exalted. Expect to see mighty people defeated and weak people victorious. Expect to see wicked people doomed and faithful people kept safe. There's going to be a very predictable pattern in these stories. We're going to keep reading Hannah and Peninnah over and over again because our God saves through great reversals. And expect this to be the story of the king as well. So remember where Hannah's prayer ends. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. And there is no human king at this point in Israel. Hannah is inspired, I think, to pray prophetically about something which she knows is to come, which actually her son Samuel will help bring about. God's provision of a king to lead his people is not separate to the idea of God's salvation coming through great reversals. This prayer is echoed in the New Testament just before Jesus is born. You can hear the same themes coming from the lips of Mary, his mother, and Zechariah, his uncle. They know the Lord looks on the humble estate of his servant, and he raises up a horn of salvation for his people in the house of his servant David. So this year we will learn lots about God's king. We'll see through King Saul and King David a blueprint for King Jesus. The Bible itself draws those connections. We don't have to make them up. Without this book, we wouldn't understand what it means for Jesus to be king. And we might be surprised by the way he looks or speaks or acts. Is it okay if Jesus looks weak or lowly or needy? Can he really be God's king if he suffers, if he dies? Well, if we remember the words of this prayer, if we remember our God saves through great reversals, it will help us to start to understand the kind of king Jesus is, the kind of king we need him to be, and how that king will bring us salvation. There's a few more questions on your sheet. You've got 20 minutes to work through them, and then I'll break in at about 1:30.
If I can break into your conversations. It's gone 1:30.
And one of the things that we really want to do at midweek is make sure we also spend time praying together in our groups. So you've got until 9 o'clock to pray together. Try not to totally detach your prayer time from what we've just been talking about and thinking about in God's Word. And if you're not sure, you know, what you want to pray immediately in response to God's Word, you know, a prayer could just be that you'd have time to this week to look again at it, think more about it. That would be a good thing to pray every week in responding to God's Word. So you up to you how you want to do this time. Your leaders will tell you. Feel free to spread out. Some groups have already spread out. That's great. And you might want to break down into smaller groups.